It was only a couple of weeks ago that I reviewed with enormous pleasure, because it's a wonderful read, Michael Robotham's latest thriller, When You Are Mine. And I referred to him, I'm sorry, Michael, who's listening to us from Sydney in Australia, I referred to him as English thriller writer Michael Robotham. And it was only when preparing for this interview that I found out, after many, many years of reading and enjoying his books, the standalone books and the Joe Lachlan books, and also the two that he has written most recently featuring Cyrus Haven. And I didn't know. It's because you write all your books and set them in the UK. That's why I thought that you were from there rather than from where you are. Hello.
Hello. Hi, John. That's true. Look, I spent about 12 years of living in England and working as a journalist there, and it's where I got my start in publishing, really. And I was a journalist and a ghostwriter there, and which is why I set my first book there. And I moved back to Australia to sort of raise my family over 20 years ago, but I've continued to set my books in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's your choice and it's worked very, very well for you and it's worked very well for your readers. But I just think Australia is such a fantastic country in which to set a thriller. You know, you think of the works of the classics, Peter Temple and Gary Disher, and then you think of the newer people who are moving into the market like Jane Harper. And I mean, there's something about the Australian environment which it makes it an extra character.
It's true, although it's interesting. You know, when I mean, people often ask me, you know, why I set my books in the UK, and the truth is that in my bottom drawer, I have the greatest ever unpublished Australian novel, which I wrote in 1985, and it was almost published. It was set in Australia, and it was almost published by Penguin in the UK, and I missed out by a single vote in a publishing meeting. And I said afterwards, you know, why? And they said, well, look, if you'd said that same story in England, Ireland, Scotland or Wales, we would have published it in a heartbeat. But because you said it in Australia, it was a little bit hard for us to sell. And obviously, the world's changed a lot since 1985, back in those days. You know, the British would read British crime fiction and the Americans would read American crime fiction. And which is why, you know, when I first sat down to write the very first Joe Lachlan book, you know, I set it in the UK. And now, of course, I've got publishers falling over themselves that want me to drag that great unpublished novel out of my bottom drawer. But while it remains in my drawer, it will always be Australia's greatest ever unpublished novel. But when I take it out, it might cease to be.
Yeah. I can't remember who it was that said every journalist has a novel in the bedside drawer, and that's where most of them should stay. One of the things about Joe Lachlan that I really enjoy, and we will, of course, get to the latest book, which is a standalone, is this brilliant mind in a crumbling body. Because in 2002, I think it was, that The Suspect, your first book, was published, and it had him in it. You gave him Parkinson's disease, and I did wonder if it was something that you had to deal with, but it's not. I've read that you based it on the child of a friend. And it really, I mean, it does. Every succeeding book, it gives you that element as a reader and, as I suppose, as the writer of it. How much more is Joe's body going to deteriorate in between the end of this novel and the start of the next one?
That's true. It's one of the reasons that really I realized that I created a use-by date with Joe Lachlan, because I aged him in real time and the Parkinson's progressed in real time. And anyone that knows anything about Parkinson's knows that there is a limit to what the body can withstand with all the drugs and operations that are possible. There's still a limit. I love that. I'm fascinated by the idea of someone having a brilliant mind in a crumbling body. It's like, to me, it's like seeing a brilliant athlete struck down by illness. So I always remember seeing that incredibly poignant moment when Muhammad Ali lit the flame at the Atlanta Olympics, you know. This man that was one of the greatest athletes I ever witnessed was this shambling, sort of shambolic, shaking sort of figure. And there was a real tragic irony to that, and I think I wanted to try to recreate that with Joe O'Loughlin, to give him this brilliant mind, but he wasn't going to be a James Bond or a Jason Bourne or a Jack Reacher who could outfight and outrun and outshoot people. He had to outthink them.
And the last Joe O'Loughlin book we had was The Other Wife in 2018, and then you did two, Cyrus Haven, and another person who's interested in the mind, and those two very good books, Good Girl, Bad Girl, and When She Was Good, and then the standalone, When You Are Mine. Does that mean Joe O'Loughlin won't be with us again?
No, I think, you know, it's funny, I'm thinking about Joe a lot at the moment because they start filming, all being well, in September in the UK, they start filming a Joe O'Loughlin TV series.
Oh, wow. Who's playing Joe?
I can't tell you. It's a really big-name actor, but it hasn't been announced publicly yet, John, so I'm sorry. I can only tease you and say it will blow you away, but I can't tell you.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
I'm not going to... Better
than Cumbies, but, okay. Kenneth Branagh.
No, he's a bit old. But no, brilliant actor. I know, it's terrible, I shouldn't say that, should I? But I suddenly thought to myself, look, if the TV series goes, you know, it all seems to be going ahead. And I suddenly thought, well, wouldn't it be nice maybe, I know I'm working on an Evie and Cyrus Haven and Evie Cormack book for next year, but I said maybe the year after it might be time to bring Joe back because it would correspond with when the TV series was being shown around the world, and it would be, you know, maybe that's the time to bring Joe back.
And then on to the latest, When You Are Mine, a central character, Philomena, known as Phil. She has a father who's a gangster in London, and because of an experience that she has after a bus bombing when she's an early teenager, she becomes a police officer. She becomes an officer in London Metropolitan Police. And at the beginning, she's called to the scene of a domestic assault. She rescues a woman, Tempe Brown, whose abuser, whose attacker, is a decorated detective. And the force doesn't like its detectives, and particularly its decorated detectives, to be caught up in anything like this. So there's an immediate reaction from within the force to her trying to bring these charges. And then other things start to happen, and she befriends Tempe Brown, and then things start to happen in that friendship. And we can't go too much more into that, because then we start to give away some very important plot elements. And I'm always intrigued as to what is the genesis of a plot idea. I know that writers like yourself will have probably 30, 40, 50 ideas whirling around at any given time. Oh, really? Okay, well, maybe 6 or 7 then. So what is it that says, this is the one?
I finish each book convinced I'll never write another, that I've used up every idea I've ever had. And suddenly to pluck another from the ether. But no, I mean, this one actually, the seeds of this one were a documentary I saw a year or two ago, and it was about domestic abuse, but perpetrated by police officers, and how the police were failing to investigate their own. They were covering up domestic violence that involved police officers. And I said, what a terrifying position to be in if you were the victim, and you knew that the very people that you would normally call upon to save you and help you wouldn't help you, and that they, even if you went to a women's shelter, they would know where those shelters were. Even if you tried to hide, they had all the facilities that the police have to track you down. You would be completely helpless in the face of that. And so that was the genesis of this idea of creating it. And also, domestic violence is obviously, it's a huge issue right around the world. You know, in Australia, we're fighting for coercive control laws to be implemented, and you know, it's become a huge hot button issue, and I wanted to tackle that subject.
And tackling it through a female central character as a male author, this thing, cultural appropriation, doesn't apply here, but perhaps there's another version of it, which is gender appropriation. And certainly in the way that you dealt with these very pertinent issues, you never stand from the pulpit and thunder down at us. Everything which highlights aspects of this incredibly important global issue are part of the plot, and that, you know, that speaks to the skill that that you have as a writer, but I wondered if, and I as a male didn't feel that what was another male doing writing about a female's experience of this issue. Is it something that you've had to deal with, criticism in that regard?
It worries me. I mean, I am aware of it. But I also think that my reply or response I sort of had prepared for people that particularly if they were to attack me saying what right have I got as a white middle aged man to be writing about these deeply female issues, like in past books I've done the same. I've written from the point of view of pregnancy and childbirth and infertility. And I mean, my answer always is, how are we ever going to achieve true equality if you don't allow a man or a woman to empathize enough with someone of another gender to try to inhabit their skin, to tell a story through their eyes? And to me, it's the ultimate in trying to empathize. And I'm surrounded by women. I've got three daughters and I've been married 35 years, and I joke that there's only myself and the dog Ollie, and we've both been spayed in our house. So, capturing a female voice isn't difficult for me because I'm surrounded by women.
Yeah, so I think it would be a shallow criticism, and it probably criticism most likely to be leveled by people who haven't read the book, to say that if you want to write about toxic masculinity, write about it from the male perspective, portray the toxic male. But that, I think anybody who reads the book will 999 out of 1,000 people who read the book will have that little qualm settled by the way in which you deal with the book.
Yeah, and I think it's, I know it's, when I have the draft, and I make sure it's read by as many women of as many ages as I can, because women are the great readers of fiction and the great readers of crime fiction. And if there is a single beat wrong, I want them to tell me that if I haven't captured, the female voice, Phil's voice. I try very hard to make it as genuine and to inhabit the skin of Philomena McCarthy, who tells this story, as I can. And to me, that is a great challenge. It's one of the great challenges. If someone, I would hate to see anyone criticize a woman writer for trying to write male characters in the first person. I mean, as a writer of fiction, people shouldn't tell me what I can and can't write. If I do it badly, criticize me. But don't tell me I can't at least try.
Well, when You Are Mine and all the books which preceded it, you do it extremely well indeed. And thank you very, very much for making some time for us this evening in Sydney to talk to us in Cape Town, South Africa. Michael Rowbotham, the latest book is called When You Are Mine.